I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk with my Franklin College colleague David Carlson, who, somewhat late in his career, has blossomed into a mystery novelist. Among his books are Enter by the Narrow Gate and Let the Dead Bury the Dead. This is a pre-recorded program, which means we won't be able to take calls, emails, or field questions via social media, such as Facebook or Twitter. But we do hope you enjoy the conversation. My guest is, again, David Carlson. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking with a colleague of mine at Franklin College, David Carlson. He is a professor of religious studies there. Want to make the conflict of interest clear there, to disclose that we do work together. He has become the author of a series of books somewhat late in career, including most recently a couple of mystery novels, Enter by the Narrow Gate and Let the Dead Bury the Dead. We're going to be talking with him about that. This is a recorded program, so we're not going to be able to take questions or comments by phone, email, or social media, but we hope you enjoy the conversation. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. So let's talk a bit about the path that that led you to become a mystery novelist.
I love to read. I think I probably almost lived in the library when I was growing up, and I loved the being taken into another world. So fiction was very was something I really enjoyed reading, and I began to toy around with that in high school a little bit, and found this. We would write, and then we would read our stories in front of the class, and I remember how the thrill I got with seeing an ending come to a story, and so I felt that way, and I felt that way even today. And that is, I consider myself the first reader of the fiction. Mm-hmm. And that is, I don't start with a necessary ending in mind where it has to go. That I try to put my characters in a situation and then see what they would do. So it started way back then. But then, as happened to a lot of people, I went in the academic direction, and my career had me writing primarily technical things within a very small niche mm-hmm. of intertestamental theological mm-hmm. work. Mm-hmm. About six or seven people in the whole world would be interested in what I was writing. So even when I I was able to have those published, I knew it was a very narrow field. But in grad school, I remember when I started my doctoral program, I also began to write fiction on the side. I quickly gave that up as grad school took more of my attention. But I look back now and think, well, that was an interesting thing mm-hmm. to play around with, that there was part of what I wanted to do that was not – I mean, I love research. I love digging. Mm-hmm. I do think of mystery writing as primarily presenting a crime or a problem, a corpse or whatever, mm-hmm. and then digging and digging and digging and hoping you find an interesting solution to this. So there's a connection to research, but I began to write the fiction actually about 22 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I wrote it at a time where there was some people within my my family, extended family, cousins and nieces and situations like nephews. And there was a number of people in that family circle that were having particularly some struggles. And I felt helpless to do much about that. And what happened in that time period is I went into a fictional world and imagined a police detective who had a similar background as myself, that is, a minister's son, who was raised in that, imagining coming to a situation where kind of a perfect storm happens, in which a case that he's working on has so absorbed him, and the way he's beginning to work on mysteries, he doesn't realize that his wife is pulling back and withdrawing. So at the very time where he probably solves the most important case of his life, his wife walks out. And at the same time, he loses his faith. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to spend time with that issue because I think losing faith is as complicated a process as having faith, particularly if you grew up in a minister's family. It's in your bones, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you stop believing, it doesn't mean that all that within you is gone. So he became a character who, in a sense, stood for my own sense of I can't solve problems. And he was able to he was tremendously insightful and intuitive. He could solve all these problems except the one that mattered to him most. Except his own. And then 3 months later, his high school daughter ran away. Mm-hmm. And she came back 4 weeks later, but 4 months later, but never told him where she had gone. And so he has that sense that this is my fault. Mm-hmm. I lost my family. I lost my daughter. And then I posed that he would have a relationship with a person very different from himself. And so the character that emerged is Father Nicholas Fortas.
And the detective.
The detective is Christopher Worthy. Yeah. Right. And Father Fortas is a Greek Orthodox monk. Mm-hmm. He eats too much. He talks too much. Mm-hmm. He's very outgoing. In a way, if you closed your eyes, you would think that he was more the detective and that Worthy was more the monk because mm-hmm. he's more withdrawn and he settles. He works on things more internally. But I found this relationship to be very healing for me. What I like to say is I don't feel I created these characters as much as I met them. Mm-hmm. And particularly with Father Fortas, he has ministered to me, and readers say some of the same things, that they really wish they knew this guy. And in a way, he's very thoughtful. He is able to take Worthy's periods of silence, knowing that Worthy, when mm-hmm. he comes close to seeing a breakthrough in a case, he often withdraws within himself. So that was 22 years ago. I started the first one. I had a literary agent who was interested in the series, but she couldn't sell it. And then I began to write some nonfiction related to religious violence issues in the world. And then about 12 years ago, I wanted to know what these two guys would be doing. Mm-hmm. And so I returned wrote the second mystery. And again, at that point, there was no sense that we were going to find a publisher for it, much as my agent tried. And then about 6 years ago, I just wanted to spend more time with these two people again and put them in a different situation. And then a year and a half ago, my agent called me and said, you know, I have really great news. And I thought she meant that my second nonfiction was picked up because I was just finishing a book on the spiritual friendship concept between religions, people of faith. Mm-hmm. And she says, no, a publisher in Seattle wants to publish your three mysteries. And the joke that emerged was that my agent said that, you know, it's really great news. And I said, I'm shocked. I said, I thought these were going to be for my grandkids. Mm-hmm. These were three books that Grandpa wrote for you. And she said, I hate to say this, but I can't remember the title of your second mystery. Mm-hmm. And I said, I can't either. Oh. I had completely forgotten the title. Yeah. And so I went back in my computer, obviously found it. Mm-hmm. But it was that situation where to receive that phone call, it was like someone said, you can have Christmas every day. because I not only took the phone call as yes, these three were going to be published, one each year, but that I was being, in a sense, nudged to spend more time with these detectives. So I'm right now finishing number six.
Wow.
In the series.
Yeah. So what? One of the things that makes the books distinctive is that they deal with questions of faith.
Yes.
And questions really spanning racial divides and racial and religious, excuse me, religious division and religious understandings.
Right.
That's somewhat unusual in Mr. You know, there have been other fiction writers who have written seriously about questions of faith. Marilynne Robinson comes to mind, for example, or, you know, any number of others. You don't see it as much in mysteries. And in some ways, these strike me as almost meditations on the nature of faith and all of that with a mystery to sort of walk us through the top parts.
That's it. No, I think you've caught it exactly, and that is, I do not consider this Christian literature.
Mm-hmm.
It has no goal of bringing people to faith. However, one of the purposes is to be able to think and talk about faith, hope, despair, loneliness as spiritual issues, relationships as spiritual issues. And so I felt that that was a niche that I knew something about, and it's best to write about something you know about. And so this has allowed me to do what you're saying, and that is to use the mystery as to capture the attention of readers. I want to find out who's behind this. Most of the mysteries most of the murders that set up the mysteries are occurring within religious communities of some sort. So I don't look at religion as an uncomplicated world. There's people in these mysteries that are very disappointing, even though they're people of faith or they're egotistical, whatever. They have their own agendas, and I try to be quite candid about that, and that is no religious community is the kingdom of God. It's made up of flawed people. And in the second mystery, one of the things that readers are wrestling with is what the main detective, Christopher Worthy, and then Father Fortas are wondering about, and that is, would it be possible for so you have a elderly priest who's found strangled in front of his altar. Mm-hmm. The question arises, was this from someone outside who broke in, and was this a robbery gone awry? Or would it be possible that there could be someone within the congregation, someone within the parish, who could have killed a priest? Mm-hmm. And so it explores those kind of issues that within every religious community, there's people in progress. Some are making progress toward the light, and unfortunately, some are making progress toward the dark, and that gets hidden within a religious community and has to be explored. I totally agree with your assessment. It's not meant to bring people to faith. It's meant to allow people to think about faith. Worthy is an example of someone who I think a lot of readers would agree, and that is the evidence of life for them suggests that there's no compassionate, loving God that's involved in this experience of our human lives. And Father Fortas never tries to change him, but Father Fortas represents a totally different understanding that he sees, in a sense, that there's God involved in cases they're working on that Worthy would say, no, that's not the way I see it. So you get on this one sense, you get choices as a reader. Do you want to identify more with this point of view on this issue or that point of view? But you also get a sense that these two guys really care about one another. They love each other. Worthy does not make friends easily, and Father Fortas is about the best friend he's ever had. And on the other hand,
Well, we may want to explore that.
Yeah, let's wait on that.
That relationship a little more after we take a break. We are talking with David Carlson, the author of, among others, Let the Dead Bury the Dead. He is one of my colleagues at Franklin College. This is a recorded program, which means that we aren't taking calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we do hope that you are enjoying the conversation. You are listening to No Limits. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking with my colleague David Carlson about his books, Let the Dead Bury the Dead and Enter by the Narrow Gate. They're mysteries with theological underpinnings. I've mentioned that he is my colleague at Franklin College. I want to make sure that I disclose that we have worked together for many years. We were talking about, before we went to the break, and I should say this is a recorded program, which means we're not taking questions or comments by phone, by email, or via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the discussion. Before we went to the break, we were talking about the relationship between the two protagonists in these novels. Police detective by the name of Christopher Worthy. Sounds like he was kind of a stand-in for a somewhat younger version of David Carlson. Father Nicholas Fortas. And you were just getting started to talk about what pulls those two together.
Right. Because there is this this major surface difference. Where Christopher Worthy is someone who's had some very painful experiences in his life, and it has cost him his family, but also his faith. And on the other hand, then you have this Greek Orthodox monk who is atypical. He eats too much. He talks too much. His abbot is always upset with him because In the realm of monastic life, which is one thing I like to explore in these mysteries, it's okay for a monk to have a avocation or a side interest, let's say in beekeeping, mm-hmm. or in cheese making, or whatever that. But it's not regular for a monk to have an interest in detective work, and so the abbot is constantly asking him, which are you? Are you a monk or are you a detective? And I think what Worthy sees about Father Fortas is that is really the wrong question. This is who he is. Mm-hmm. Part of his insight into people is the fact that he's heard a lot of confessions mm-hmm. in his life. And one of the things that surprised me about Father Fortas, but then is something that I really have enjoyed about him, is that he has a different agenda about how a mystery should end. Worthy's a typical policeman. Let's find the guy before he or she kills again. Father Fortas is obviously interested in that, but has this other concern that is he wants to give the killer an opportunity to confess mm-hmm. and to come to a sense of accountability as part of this process. So that's for me, that's an intriguing difference. It has helped me see those that are the killers of these mysteries as more human because mm-hmm. I see them through Father Fortas's eyes. And that is no one starts their life saying, I want to be a killer when I grow up. And so this is often the case of people at a critical moment going in one direction rather than another and then finding that they get caught in that direction. And Father Fortas is much more attuned to that idea that people fall into darkness rather than opt for it, choose that. I don't want to be dark. No, I want to solve a problem, and I made a mistake in trying to solve it this way, and now I'm on this road. And were these more of the let's solve the crime. Let's put the guy away.
Did I misread? I mean, or mishear when you were talking earlier about sort of the inspiration for these mm-hmm. with Christopher Worthy, that you saw him as this police detective when I'm presuming it was your birth extended family that was going through
right.
some difficulties.
Yeah.
And obviously, you chose a very different route. You didn't become a police officer. I happen to know, because as I've said, we've been colleagues for a long
sure,
time,
sure.
that you've been married for a long time, so you didn't lose your wife.
No.
You didn't lose your faith.
No.
You're a minute. But was there a quality of in exploring this, taking a look at, okay, this is what might have happened if I had fallen, I could have taken a different direction.
Absolutely. And that's why I don't want the reader to feel that there's going to be some moment where faith is all of a sudden going to become easy for him again. Because one of my interests in my career in teaching religious studies is something called faith development. Mm-hmm. And it's a theory. It's obviously a kind of a humanistic theory. It's not an exact science kind of thing. But it explores the sort of based primarily on Dr. James Fowler from Candler, but that's also based on Eric Erickson and Piaget and Kohlberg's understanding of moral development. And it really looks at how a person has certain critical moments of life where perhaps what we might call the faith membrane is thin. Mm-hmm. And if certain things happened at that point, that membrane would just burst apart. It would mm-hmm. collapse or cave in or whatever you want to say. And so part of my career, I was in counseling before I got into teaching, and students frequently over the years come in my office, close the door, and express often tearfully struggles they're having in their faith journeys. And I've always said to them, and that is, I do not have an answer mm-hmm. to if you're asking me, where does this go? But I do have this. I celebrate your journey, as painful as it may be right now. What's happening to you is really important. And you might look back on this and say, that was actually a wonderful part of my life that was painful. And so then that to jump from that to a character who, in a sense, would represent that kind of person mm-hmm. who might come into my office, knowing that I would not try to tell them how to fix their lives, because I don't believe that's my role. I take the faith journey so seriously that I don't see myself as knowing where it should end up in a person's life, as much as I can maybe celebrate points on the journey that they may have missed and not understood as positive, and that even some struggles, let's say, with family. I have questions now, and my family doesn't understand where all these doubts and questions are coming from. And for me to be able to help the student or the person mm-hmm. See that as a natural part of faith growing rather than faith diminishing, which mm-hmm. is often what they're being told. Worthy is exactly that for me. Worthy is an opportunity for me to humanize loss of faith as a really strong possibility in a person's life. And it just happens to hit him at a critical moment where his career is flourishing and his wife walks out and his daughter runs away. And he almost loses his job at that point because he becomes so ineffective. He can't sleep. He can't think. He can't focus. And in a sense, Father Fortas comes into Christopher Worthy's life on a case that was unexpected. They brought them together. And then I have to keep creating a premise with each mystery as to why they would be together on another case, because he is a monk in Ohio and Christopher Worthy is a detective in Detroit. So I have to figure out a way that they get back together. But I, 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 I have really enjoyed that imaginative journey that you're talking about. And it's not pure imagination, as I said, because I think you can imagine whatever, wherever I've been in my life, when I meet people and they find out I teach religious studies, one of the things that often happens to me is that a person will say, let's have lunch, let's have dinner. And at that occasion, they'll say, here's why I no longer believe. And I'll go, I don't believe that way either. And they become surprised that I thought faith meant I had to believe all these things. It's like, no, that's sort of what a child believes perhaps about faith. But I gave that understanding up as well. I don't say it to try to pull them back into faith, but I do want them to know that faith is not turning off your mind. It is not saying, I don't think seriously about difficult matters.
And I want to talk a little bit also about, the inspiration for the Father Fortas character.
Yes.
But given that we're on this subject, one of the themes that comes across in the books, too, is, and is often essential to understanding the unraveling of the mystery, is understanding the many different manifestations of faith, or understanding and accepting different faith traditions. When and how did that become important to you?
It came out of my own journey. There is for me. There has been moments in my life, and clearly a specific moment about 25 years ago, a couple of years before I started writing the mysteries, in which I felt, after doing a lot of reading in Quaker spirituality and Thomas Merton's wonderful monastic writings, just what a terrific writer, I realized that I was looking for a more contemplative tradition. And I actually came into the Orthodox Church at that time and have been in that tradition now for 25 years. I grew up Baptist, so that was kind of a big jump. Coming into the Orthodox faith for me seemed to open my sense of where God works. And I found myself much more sensitive to how the religions that I was teaching in my class, that these were paths that offered people greater meaning, and that people, individuals encountered God in these traditions. And what really moved me was not only encountered God, but really grasped the love of God and a love for God. And I began to, in a way, instead of narrowing down, I began to sense that this is what my Sikh brothers, like my Sikh friends in Indianapolis, KP Singh and others, these are what they're experiencing. This is what my Muslim friends that I go to Shapiro's once a week to eat with a group of Christian Muslims, and they've been meeting for 22 years in the middle of Shapiro's, not in the back room, in the middle of Shapiro's, and we don't talk about faith particularly. We just care for one another. And the premise of the group is to do the will of God on a daily basis, and to challenge us to do that. And so, I began to open out to where this it was happening in all these religious traditions, not as a way of, in a sense, saying they're all the same, but in a sense, feeling that they're all different, but they all provide this opportunity to know this loving presence, and. So that is part of what I want to bring into these mysteries, is that I do want to bring in people from different religious traditions in which obviously there's differences theologically, but perhaps as I think Thomas Merton found and the Quakers have found, and that is at the depth of faith where words are not that important, there is a stream, a river, and religions have people that go to that place. Some find it through Islam. Some find it through Judaism. Some find it through different religions. Not everybody finds it. A lot of people are mm-hmm. much more interested in the theological differences and debating. Something that Pope Francis said that I put in my talks is, remember when you're in a dialogue, you're not in a dialogue just with ideas. You're in a dialogue with a person. They have a story. They have a past. They have a unique experience. Open your heart to that and listen to that life, that experience. And I think what he's implying is what I found, and that is when we open our heart to people who come from different labels than we do, I feel that God meets me.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with my Franklin College colleague David Carlson about his mystery novel series. The two entries that have been published so far are Enter by the Narrow Gate and Let the Dead Bury the Dead. This is a recorded program, so we're not able to take calls or emails or messages via social media. We do hope, though, that you're enjoying the conversation. So let's talk a little bit about, obviously, you found a kind of model for the detective,
yeah,
Christopher Worthy, and yourself, and in a, you know, the path not taken, as it were.
Right.
Where does Father Fortas come from?
My sister has asked me the same question. Various people that read the mysteries that know me say, he sounds like you at times. And my response is, if he sounds like me, it's like I would like to be in my best moments. He's not a perfect person, but he is. We talk a lot in the current situation about emotional intelligence, and he has high spiritual intelligence. I have a conversation between Worthy and his daughter, who they're somewhat reconciled, not perfectly, but she asks him about Father Fortas. And so we get to hear Worthy say, she asks him, like, do you think he prays for you? And Worthy says, yeah, I'm sure he does. Mm-hmm. And she says, what's his God like? And Worthy sort of fumbles around and basically says, I think it's a little bit like, I understand his God. He's a little bit like a trickster. And that is surprises. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily expected what this God being is going to do. And when she then later in the story asked Father Fortas about his trickster God, Father Fortas says, I don't know what you're talking about. mm-hmm. But he says, well, wait a minute. Maybe I do. And so Father Fortas is someone who, in a sense, is not a monk who is a monk saying, I have a deeper understanding of God than you do, than other people do. He is, in a sense, saying, I spend more time with a mysterious God, unpredictable God, obviously a God that doesn't keep people from getting killed, mm-hmm. obviously doesn't prevent families from breaking apart or children running away or some horrendous things happening in these books, but a God who is, although unpredictable, is there in some way. Father Fortas is in a way not speaking for God as much as he's listening for God.
We are talking with my Franklin College colleague, David Carlson, who rather late in his career has developed a new sideline, as it were. You're still a full-time college, well, I guess half-time during part of the year, college professor, but as a mystery novelist. He's written a couple of mystery novels, including Enter by the Narrow Gate and Let the Dead Bury the Dead, that feature a Detroit police detective and a Greek Orthodox priest who have a friendship and, as part of that friendship, tend to solve murders together. This is a recorded program, which means that we are not taking calls, emails, or messages via social media, but we do hope that you are enjoying the conversation. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today with my Franklin College colleague, David Carlson, about his series of mystery novels and his writings. Again, I want to emphasize he is a colleague of mine at Franklin College, so the audience does not think I am withholding anything. This is a recorded program, so we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. We do hope you're enjoying the conversation. David, I want to talk with you now, I think, about this, because even before the mystery novels came across, were published, you had developed a reputation and definitely an interest in finding ways across religious divides. If anything, it seems that if there's a theme to your writing and to your work, it is that we need to take time to understand each other and not rush to judgment. You've done a lot of work on ISIS. You've done a lot of work on other faith traditions. I guess I want to take the conversation, if I can, in this last segment in a somewhat different direction and talk about, not that different because it is a primary theme in the novels too, but what are the obstacles to that sort of understanding? Why do we find that, and I'm using we in the collective sense here, humanity, why do human beings find it so hard to bridge those divides or at least to, in some cases, to even acknowledge that they are there. What is the source of that?
Yeah, that's the big question. Is this part of our nature that we're tribal and we need to define ourselves by not only saying what we are, but who we're not? So we have to find those that are different from us and create a tension. I have been very interested my whole life, I suppose, with something I'd later described as how can we build bridges rather than walls separating us? My second nonfiction book, which is Countering Religious Extremism, The Healing Power of Spiritual Friendships, starts really with the idea of looking at three hurdles. The low hurdle is tolerance. Mm-hmm. And tolerance is, unfortunately, something that we have, in a sense, in the United States said, well, you were a tolerant country. And compared to other countries of the world, that there's a truth to that. But tolerance is really quite a low hurdle because we tolerate a headache. We tolerate screaming kids on an airplane. And when 9/11 happened, tolerance was exposed to be a little bit of a, I don't really know you. I don't care to know you. You stay down the street from me. I'll leave you alone. You leave me alone. After 9/11, we began to, now I'm worried about that person living down the street. The second hurdle, the mid hurdle range, is what I call understanding. And that's when people say, well, I really need to know after 9/11 more about Islam. I need to know more about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. I need to know about the Rohingya in Myanmar. And so understanding is much better than tolerance because mm-hmm. understanding leads us to truths about other traditions. But understanding can be done at a distance. You can read a book. You can mm-hmm. attend a lecture. You can get a series on PBS and say, I think now I've gained that. The high hurdle, which is what the second nonfiction book is built around, is spiritual friendship. And that is, what would a relationship be like between people of different faiths in which my goal would not be to change you into being like me, but I would encourage you to be a better representation of your faith, and you would encourage me, in my case a Christian, to be a better Christian. And so that led me to look for opportunities to spend time with people of different faiths in which we would start with that premise, and that is we're not here to change one another. I'm here to learn how you, as in many of the cases of that book, how you as a Muslim or a Muslim group or a Jewish group or whatever could help me deepen my own faith. This is, again, not to be espouse relativism, saying that all faiths are the same. It is to say, however, that the position that the Catholic Church took after Vatican II makes a lot of sense, and that is, as a Christian, I can believe that God has most clearly revealed himself in Jesus Christ, but I do not discount the fact that God has revealed himself in other faiths. Mm-hmm. And so I don't not listen to others. I don't see them as without truth. As Eboo Patel said at Franklin College several years ago when he was there, I expect you as a Christian audience to think your faith is the best. You should expect me as a Muslim to think my faith is the best. That doesn't mean that we cannot have a relationship. So I began to look deliberately at entering spiritual friendships with this different goal in mind, not to convert, but to encourage one another. And that led me to a group in Indianapolis, the Shapiro Group, that's been meeting at the Shapiro's Deli for 22 years. They are internationally known in a way that they are not known locally. They are heroes at the Vatican. They're often invited to the Vatican to talk about Christian-Muslim relations, how this works. And they have a model of a neutral site, not meeting in the church, not meeting in the basement of a mosque, not in the synagogue. We're meeting at a public place in public space, not in a back room hiding, in which it's happened that people come and see us there, and they'll stop and they'll say, what are you guys about? Because we're interracial as well as interfaith. Mm-hmm. And someone will say, well, we're Muslims and Christians primarily, and although others are invited, but we meet weekly. We had this one guy that had came and asked this question. He drew up a chair, and he said, let's get it on. And they said, what do you mean, let's get it on? Let's get the debate on. Let's get the fight on. They said, that's not what we're about. Mm-hmm. And so that led me to that group. And then at the end of that book, I had read this account in the New York Times of Omaha, Nebraska, which is not considered a liberal part
Bastion,
of the country.
No.
And Tri-Faith Initiative in Omaha, there was a Reform synagogue that was given a defunct golf course out in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And they were had run out of space in the inner city, and they were moving out there. It was 40 acres. And the very insightful, charismatic rabbi said, who do we want as our neighbors? Because they had shared parking with the Methodists downtown. Mm-hmm. Jews worship on Friday night, Saturday morning. Mm-hmm. Well, Methodists on Sunday morning worked out fine. They got to know each other. It was really positive. And so when they moved out to the suburb, they said, who do you want as our neighbor? And the rabbi answered his own question. He said, we want the Muslims of Omaha as our neighbor, and we want the Christians as our neighbor. Mm-hmm. So they gave acreage to both the Muslim community of Omaha and to the Christian community on this old golf course. And I went out and interviewed both my nonfiction or interview-based books. I just get really intrigued with hearing people. You're a journalist. You know what that's like. It's very exciting. Mm-hmm. So I'm out there, and I'm interviewing the various players in this. The synagogue's already been built. The mosque has had a groundbreaking. The Christians were the last to get their act together, not surprisingly. But they're building. And so in this old golf course, there was this creek that was called Hell Creek because it swallowed golf balls. And so when the Muslim leader was asked, certainly if you're going to move out there, you're going to rename the creek. And he said, no, actually, we're going to build a bridge over hell. Mm-hmm. And between these three different facilities, their worship, we're not talking about hybridization here. We're not talking about joining together and saying nice things. Each worship separately, and in the middle will be built the Tent of Abraham, which celebrates the Abrahamic tradition of inviting the stranger into the tent. And that's where interfaith efforts will take place. And there will literally be a bridge built over Hell Creek. The last day I was there, I was walking the grounds. And it dawned on me, I have not visited Jerusalem since I was really in grad school. And but I was thinking how odd this was, that the acreage of this golf course, where these mm-hmm. three faiths were going to be, was roughly similar to the acreage around the Wailing Wall, the holiest site in Judaism,
mm-hmm.
The mosques on top of Temple Mount, mm-hmm. the third holiest site in Islam, and down the street, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the holiest site in Christianity. Here in Jerusalem, where the friction between these three is so strong that the Christian Church of the Holy Sepulchre had to hire, there's so much fighting within mm-hmm. the Christian community, they had to hire, in most of its history, a Muslim gatekeeper because they didn't trust one another. And then you had the tension between Jews and Muslims, in Arab Jews and Arab Muslims and Arab Christians within the city. And here you had in Omaha, you had these three faiths choosing to be together, similar acreage. And I had this vision that in the future, people would take a pilgrimage, not just to Jerusalem, but they would take a pilgrimage to Omaha, Nebraska, and to Abraham's tent. And they would see these three faiths that had chosen to be neighbors. First of all, sharing ground. Then I believe sharing prayers for one another. And of course, this is very fragile.
Mm-hmm.
Disaster happens. Bombings happen in Israel. And Omaha reacts. The mm-hmm. community begins to pull apart. And they've had some really difficult moments.
Let me ask you, and I should say to our audience that if you're just joining us, this is a recorded program. We're not taking calls, emails, or messages via social media. We're talking with my Franklin College colleague, professor of religious studies, David Carlson, on this third, the highest hurdle here.
Right. Spiritual friendship.
Spiritual friendship. That also seems, it would seem to me one of the prerequisites for that, too, is a deep and fundamental appreciation of that other faith.
Yes.
Too. So I want to ask, out of the other faith traditions that you've looked at, what are the truths that have emerged from that study that have shaped your own thought and shaped your own faith?
Oh, wonderful question. And I have a specific answer. One of the spiritual friendship relationships I entered was with a Muslim, also someone in higher education at another institution in Indiana. We began to meet somewhat regularly. And I basically, he said, I can give you an hour each time, and it usually went 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And a specific thing happened that I think is one of the ways of getting at your question. And that is, I came to the third meeting with him, and I said, I have a question about prayer. Prayer is very important in Islam. Prayer is very important in Christianity. But in Islam, I have a hard time understanding, because the goal in Islam is to live in something called God consciousness. And that is to not forget God. There's two major sins in Islam. One is idolatry, worshiping something other than God, and the other is forgetting God. Mm-hmm. And I confess that forgetting God is very easy for me to do. Mm-hmm. And I said, so you try to live with God consciousness. Why would you stop five times a day to pray specifically if you're already in God consciousness? Well, we got off on something that he began to talk about. We usually talked, as I said, for 2.5 hours. At the end of 30 minutes, I said, we got to stop right there. What you've shared with me has so changed my thinking that I need to stop right now and say I can't take any more. And what it was his comment, not about specifically answering my question, but he said, you know, it's very important in Islam, something called niyya, and it's the intention of the heart before you pray. And I asked him to share more of that, and he said, well, in prayer, we're coming before the Lord of the universe. And so we don't just come saying, gimme, gimme, gimme. I want, mm-hmm. you know, I need this. You know, you're not aware of this. But you come knowing that this is the being that knows your life better than you know yourself, knows your needs better than you do. And so the response of Nia is to immediately surrender to God in prayer. And I said, stop right there, because you've just helped me understand my Lord's Prayer in a new way. Mm-hmm. I said, I've been praying the Lord's Prayer since my parents taught it to me, probably when I was 3 years old. I had always assumed that the heart of the prayer was, give us this day our daily bread, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive others, lead us not into temptation, and deliver us from evil. Mm-hmm. I thought that was the meat. And I thought the other, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name, your will be done on earth as is in heaven. I thought that was just intro. And what I realized as Marwan was talking to me was, oh my gosh, that if you start with, may your will be done on earth as is in heaven, that's the prayer. Mm-hmm. That's what prayer is, and that is not my will, but yours be done. Jesus models that in his last week of his life. And so I was very happy in that book to say, my Muslim friend taught me to pray in a different way and has changed my prayer life completely. I don't pray the same way. I pray thinking, first of all, what's my intention here? If I come to make subtle demands, have I come to ask God to bless a path that I've already taken? Mm-hmm. And say, honor, you know, here's what I'm doing. I want you to bless me. Or do I start with the idea, you know better than I do. And so I'm just going to present those issues in my life and in those that I care about. I'm going to present them to you as you are the Lord of the universe and a loving Father, rather than somebody that I can get to do my will. So that for me was just a powerful change that had happened. And another thing happened at the end of that book that was just like the way I don't have time to share it, but it was just like light upon light upon light. And it was a situation in which my Christian faith had more light shown by my Muslim brothers and then my Jewish brothers and sisters shown more light on that. I realized that God was speaking in a three-dimensional way to me.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guest and my colleague and friend, David Carlson, professor of religious studies at Franklin College, also somewhat late in life, a mystery novelist who has written published two mystery novels, Enter by the Narrow Gate and Let the Dead Bury the Dead. Sounds like there are four more in the pipeline.
That's right.
Including one that will be coming out this year. I'd also like to thank our listeners for joining us. Hope you have enjoyed this enlightening conversation. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.